All right, page 13, Hebrews chapter 5. I want to briefly pick up where we left off last week. Not to go over it again, just for and to be redundant, but the theme from the end of chapter 4 just goes right into chapter 5, and so I want to pick that train of thought up again. And these are the slides that we ended with last time. Chapter 4, verse 14, begins to really address this idea of Jesus as the high priest. And I forgot to ask, anybody need a copy of the material? I have a few more copies up here. If you don't have pages, starting with page 10, it's lessons 3 and 4. I think everybody has them. Okay. This is where the writer begins to really discuss in great detail, of course, one of the, if not the main subject of Hebrews with respect to Jesus, which is what? His role is what? High priest, our great high priest. And so in the next several chapters, at the end of 4, all of 5, all of 6, and all of 7, basically, his role as the high priest. And again, let's not forget that that would be directly on theme with his audience, because, again, what kind of people were they? I mean, I know they were Christians, but what was the relevance? They were Jewish Christians, and they're entertaining a return back to the law. And so if the writer can convince in their minds Jesus' covenant is superior to Moses, Jesus' priesthood is superior to Aaron's, which they are, then that would cement in their minds it would be futile to go back to this inferior system. And so that's why the Holy Spirit will spend a lot of time developing this main idea. Jesus has passed through the heavens. We see that there in verse 14. Since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then, or therefore, with confidence, draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in the time of need. We didn't really go back and read the passage from Leviticus 16 and verse 12, but if you go back and look at that, that passage dealt directly with the high priest's duties on what day? That would be germane to this discussion. The Day of Atonement. When Aaron was to take the blood of the bull of sin offering, take that with him, he would put incense on the altar of incense, and then the text says he would go then behind the veil, and he would offer the blood for sins for himself first, and then for the people. And then the writer says, Christ has gone through the heaven. Christ has gone behind the veil. We did look at chapter 9, 23 and 24 of Hebrews. But I do want to quickly look at these two passages to see that the book of Hebrews is making this point rather emphatically. Turn ahead just for a few minutes to chapter 6. Look at verses 19 and 20. All right, Ralph, when you find that, would you read for us Hebrews 6, verses 19 and 20? All right, your version uses the word veil. Some versions use the word curtain. So he's gone into the real most holy place to make intercession with God. Then also chapter 9, verses 23 and 24. Wanda, when you have that, would you read for us, please, Hebrews 9. I think we did look at this passage last week. Hebrews 9, 23 and 24. Okay, so there you see the idea of Christ going through the veil, going through the curtain. Heavens are likened to the curtain. As Aaron went behind the veil, so did Christ go through or behind the veil to the most holy place. And so that being the case, him being our great high priest, the the chapter concluded with a great exhortation, chapter 4, verse 16. Therefore, that is to say, since this is true, since this is really what He's done for us, what are we exhorted or encouraged to do? We can go before that throne. Why? Because our high priest is there. He's making intercession for us. And we're even told how to come to the throne. Boldly. We have with confidence. Not with hesitancy. Not with apprehension or doubt or anything like that. But with confidence we can approach that throne. Not boldness in terms of cockiness or arrogance, as if we have earned it, we deserve it. No, but with confidence because of what He has done. We may find mercy and find grace to help in time of need. One thing that I did want to stress, and I don't think I said this last week, and this gets to question 3 on page 13. What I'm calling there, and I put the word in quotation marks, deficiencies. Maybe you had didn't. What is he asking when he asked that question? What deficiencies of the Mosaic Covenant are emphasized? Well, in the Old Testament, could the average Hebrew approach the most holy place? No. It was only through the priest. But as today, as New Testament priests, we can on our own, without having to go through an intermediary, that is a priest, our high priest is continually there. And so we can approach that holy place, the most holy place, at any time. We don't need any go-between or anybody to mediate for us. That's a deficiency of the Mosaic Covenant that's not found in the New Testament Covenant. And secondly, was there grace and mercy to be found in the Old Covenant? No, it didn't offer grace and mercy. Because when Aaron went behind the veil, then he did those duties. Well, next year when the day rolled around, what was remembered? Those sins. That's right. They had to keep being remembered. No mercy, no grace. But in this covenant, we can find mercy and grace because true forgiveness has happened. That did not happen under the first covenant. So as the writer brings this chapter to a close, there's just a lot in these three verses alone in terms of making the comparison between the two covenants. Now, right into chapter 5, and let's just read. The thought really will stop at verse 10. So let's read the first 10 verses of Hebrews 5. Lori Fielder, would you read Hebrews 5, verses 1 through 10 for us? And then we'll make our comments. Okay, thank you. Well, we come right into chapter 5 now, and the question I'm asking, this is question 4. I'll give you three blanks here. And again, this word in quotations is mine. I'm not saying that the Bible calls it this, but getting us to think along these lines. You're talking about the priesthood, or mainly the high priest. There were certain qualifications that had to be met for a man to serve as high priest. Now, a lot of them would be, of course, outside our study. Like, for example, he had to be of the tribe of Levi. Well, we're not talking about that, but that would be a qualification. He had to be of the family of Aaron to be the high priest. That's a qualification, but that, again, is not in the text here. Just using the first 4 verses of chapter 5, I found 3 qualifications that a priest, after the order of Aaron, had to meet that the writer proves Jesus also met. That's where I was going with this. All right. In verse 1, what was one of these qualifications? I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. All right. Well, yes, that's correct. He offered sacrifices for sins. That is true. All right. From among men. He had to be chosen from among men. So, in verse 1, the writer says, every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men. Now, you may think that's rather obvious and nothing that really needs to be proven, but again, where did the Old Testament priests come from? Well, they came from the tribe of Israel. From the nation of Israel, from the tribe of Levi, from the family of Aaron. So they had to be selected from among men. Now, we pause right here. Was Christ our high priest? Was he selected from among men? Well, the chapter 2, and we've already been through the first two chapters, gave us both halves of the identity of Christ. His divine side, but also His human side. So He came and lived as a man to serve as our high priest. That's one point. All right. Secondly, look in verse 2. What did the high priest have to do? Or what was he able to do? Yeah, he had compassion. Now, Bill, how was that worded that, or shown that he had compassion based on verse 2? All right. He could deal or needed to deal gently with the wayward. I think that's how the English Standard Version reads. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward. Other translations, let's see, this is verse 2. He can have compassion on those who are ignorant and going astray. He understands what it's like. Now, if Jesus hadn't been made a man, how would that have fit him? Well, it wouldn't have. He wouldn't have known what it was like to be human. We've already covered in verse 14 of chapter 4. How did it stress the humanness of Jesus? Well, we have a great high priest who can sympathize with us because why? He's been tempted in all points. So he knows what that's like to be human. So the high priest would know how to deal gently in terms of teaching, in terms of offering mediation between the people and God, because he himself is beset with the same weaknesses. That applies to Jesus too. I think more will be said about that in verse when we get to verse 7, just in a moment. All right. Now, in verse 4, I think, is the third qualification. All right. They must be divinely appointed. Who chose the priests? Well, God did. The tribe of Levi, God chose it. The family of Aaron, God chose it. And top of the next page, we'll get to this question just in a moment. I've asked you from some Old Testament passages, this is question 5, top of page 14, back from Exodus 28 as well as Numbers 16. Here were some examples of this very thing that the writer is talking about. So they must be divinely appointed. Who picked Jesus as high priest? Well, God did. In fact, the writer quotes the psalm again, "You are my son, today I have begotten you. Thou art a priest forever, after or according to the order of Melchizedek." Written centuries before the Christ even came. But that was already, of course, in the mind and plan of God. Now, look at top of page 14, and I'm asking here, in Exodus 28 and verse 1, let's just apply this to what we just learned. This phrase here in Hebrews 5 and verse 1, every high priest chosen from among men. Well, look at Exodus 28 and verse 1. Remember, at the last part of Exodus, especially when you get to chapter 20 and beyond, from Exodus 20, well, Exodus 19 rather, Exodus 19, all the way through Numbers 10, where was the nation of Israel geographically? They was at Mount Sinai. After they were redeemed from bondage, and they stayed there almost a whole year, 11 months and about 10 or 20 days. I forget what it is exactly, but almost a whole year. They got the law, they built the tabernacle, they arranged all the garments for the priesthood. God set apart the priest to serve him. Exodus 28, and this is in that section, it's in that time frame, verse 1. Brady, read that verse for us. Exodus 28, verse 1. Caught you off guard, didn't I? All right, I'm focusing on the phrase there. Bring near to you Aaron, your brother and his sons from among the people. See, they were chosen from the people. Just like the writer says here. That's how it was with choosing priests in the Old Covenant. That's how it is with choosing the priest or the high priest under the New Covenant. Chosen from among men. Christ was a man. Now, the story in Numbers 16, we won't read the whole chapter, but it's a story that I know that you know very well. In Numbers 16, there was a problem. Three men got feeling a little too high on themselves. Remember what their names were? Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Yeah. What was their complaint against Moses? Let's just paraphrase it for time's sake. Yeah. Hasn't gone. He spoke. You know, he's dealing through us also. So they wanted to take the fire pans, perform these duties. And so God had to set that straight. Now we know how it turned out. The earth opened up and swallowed them up whole. But the point I'm making is, and I do want to, I guess, turn to that and look at one particular verse. Let me see if I can find it right quick. Numbers 16. And when God is speaking on this matter, yeah, starting verse 4. When Moses heard their complaint, when Moses heard it, he fell on his face, and he said to Korah and to all his company, "In the morning the Lord will show who is His, who is holy, and who will bring Him near to Him. The one whom He chooses," is the phrase I'm focusing on. "The one whom He chooses, He will bring near to Him." See, in the Old Covenant, God chose who would be His priest. And so that certainly fits point number 3 there. They were divinely appointed. And God did show who was His. He had made His choice with Aaron, not with the others. And they suffered punishment. So here is just a couple of real quick examples that prove that the Old Testament priesthood had to meet these qualifications. Likewise, under the New Covenant, Christ meets the very same qualifications. It's just on a higher scale, if you will. He's our priest. He's our high priest, just like Aaron was theirs. So we finish in verse 4 when the writer says, "No one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was." Now look at verse 5. How does it begin? "So also, or in like manner, is Christ." What did Christ not do, according to verse 5? Yeah, He didn't. Being a son of God, did He have the right? He's not only human, He's God. But even the Son of God did not take this office to Himself. He was appointed in that office by his own Father. So again, he's meeting these same qualifications as our high priest. He didn't exalt Himself. Makes us think of, say, Philippians 2, verses 6 through 9, when Paul says in that passage, "Have this mind in you which was also in Christ Jesus, who although He existed in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but laid aside His privileges, emptied Himself, taking the form of a bondservant, and being made in the likeness of men." The passage concludes, what did God do to Him after He did all that? "Therefore He has exalted Him and given Him the name of which is above every name." So Christ didn't exalt Himself. He waited for His Father to do that after His priestly or high priestly duties were finished. And so that certainly comes into play. But was appointed by Him who said to Him then, and as Lori read these verses for us, the end of verse 5, "Thou art My Son. Today I have begotten Thee." Again, quoting the 95th Psalm, which we've seen that a lot of Psalms quotations already in our study so far, especially in the early chapters. So he fulfilled his priestly duties. Now, when he says in verse 7, this is where I want to allude to earlier, in the days of his flesh, or this, that is, in the days when he was walking the earth, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. I've got on the chart, going back to verse 15, chapter 4, where again we are reminded that we have a high priest who can sympathize with us. And that certainly comes to mind as we look at this verse. But I want you to think in verse 7, and maybe this has never occurred to you, maybe it has, I don't know, but it certainly has occurred to me. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears. When did Jesus, as you think back on this, when did Jesus pray and approach the throne? Well, yes, numerous times, you're right, but specifically what comes to your mind? The Garden of Gethsemane. Turn to Mark 14. Let's look at that passage just real quickly. Mark 14. To me, Hebrews 5 and verse 7 is the best commentary that I know of that makes us think of those agonizing moments in the garden when Jesus was in the very it's right in the shadow of the cross. It's right there at it. Bill, when you have that, would you read the Mark 14 verses 33 through 36, please? Well, see, start at verse 32. I'm sorry. Okay, Mark 14. That should say 32, not 33. But let's go 32 through 36. Thank you. Okay. When you look at this, the gospel record of it, his words, first verse 33, as Mark records this, he took the three disciples on further from the other eight. Judas is not with them now. He began to be deeply troubled and distressed. He knew what was right in front of him. He says to them in verse 34, those very things. I'm deeply sorrowful, even to death. Then verse 35, he went and prayed a little further and fell on the ground. And Mark records for us what he says in verse 36. But what does Hebrews 5 and verse 7 add to this moment that's not recorded for us in the gospel record? Just how deep it was. Absolutely. He was heard because of his reverence, yes. But the writer says in Hebrews 5 and verse 7, in the days of his flesh, now I cannot prove that this is only speaking about this moment in the garden. It may have been at other times also. But to me, it certainly fits. I think that's the point that is being made. But be that as it may, he offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears, loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. I've often wondered this. I don't want to speculate too much, but to me, I think it's a fair question. I wonder how loud Jesus got, crying and just so beset with trouble. Back in Mark 14, it just says that he went a little further from the disciples. What did they do while he prayed? They slept. Now, Luke says they slept from sorrow. They were exceedingly sorrowful, but they still slept. Wonder how they could sleep through that. Looking at Hebrews 5 and verse 7, the Lord was wailing. He was offering loud cries, vehement cries, with full-blown tears. That shows you the depth to which he had gone, agonizing over this decision. And then, of course, his words, as we read, and I chose Mark's word particularly, Mark 14, verse 36, when he says, all things are possible. You can do this any other way. Remove this cup from me. He didn't want to go through it. This was his human weakness. But he didn't end the sentence right there. He said, yet not what I will. I'm not going to yield to that. I'm going to yield to your will, what thou will. He had tears. Yes, he was. Yeah. No. Of course not. That's obviously so. Good. Okay. That's a good point to make. So he was beset with great weakness while he was completely human. And that makes him this great. Again, connecting this back to Hebrews 4 and verse 15, he is a high priest who can sympathize with everything we go through because he has been through it. In fact, he's been through more than I'm ever going to go through. That's really the point. Bill, your hands up. Right. God did hear his prayer. Yeah. Yes. No. Absolutely not. And it's of course we're not surprised that Jesus qualified his request in verse 36 of Mark 14. He didn't stop with, I don't want to do this, let's do it some other way. No, but it's what thou wilt. So he was heard. And the reason why, Hebrews 5, verse 7, why was he heard? Because of his reverence or his godly fear. That's why the Lord heard his prayer. So he does meet our qualification, or he does meet the qualification to serve as high priest. Just like Aaron had to meet those qualifications, so does Christ. On every point, it is exactly parallel. Okay. Now, you get to verse 8, off-quoted verses, Hebrews 5, 8, and 9. Some people may be shocked by this. But the writer makes the point, even Christ had to learn what? To obey. And he's the Son of God. Why would he have to obey? Because at this point he's also him. And even though he were the Son, yet learned he obedience. How did he learn it? By the things which he suffered. So even Christ learned to obey. Even Christ learned to submit to the will of the Father. And that's the point for us. We must learn to obey as well. And so, since he learned obedience, what benefit is there from his learned obedience? Verse 9. And being made perfect or complete, he became the author, or source, is the word, of eternal salvation to who? Those who do the same thing, to those who obey. Yes, Ralph? No. Right. Yes. What's one of the great teachers for us in learning what's right and what's wrong? Well, mistakes we make. Yeah, experience. But you're right. Jesus didn't learn, well, this is my Father's will because I've tried this and that didn't work. I tried this and that didn't work. No, he learned it through experiencing totally what it is to be beset with human weakness, with temptation, and with trials, yet never giving in to them. Yes, he always knew. Yes, being subject to those temptations did not remove his divineness. He always knew the will of God, and he never backed away from it. That's a good point to make. Okay. So being made perfect, he became the author or the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. Now the writer's bringing this thought to a close. He learned obedience. He became the source of salvation. And then how's he wrap this up in verse 10? This one thought. being designated or being made a high priest on the order of Melchizedek. And right at this point, Hebrews 5 and verse 10, is a discussion that is begun about Melchizedek. Now, this question I'm about to ask is directly on theme of what their author is going to say. What if you don't know who Melchizedek is? Someone says, never heard of the guy. Well, where does that put you in trying to understand this book? I don't mean the Bible. I mean this particular book of Hebrews. Yeah, kind of. You are in the dark. Never heard of the guy. Who was he? What did he do? When did he live? All those questions would come to mind. And the priesthood of Christ is on the order of this man. And so if you don't know him or his priesthood, what does that mean? You can't know Christ and his priesthood. That just stands to reason. So the writer will bring this now, this point up, saying, being designated by God a high priest on the order or after the order, according to the order of Melchizedek. Yes. It's the tribe of Levi. That's right. Right. Of course, being a Jewish audience and knowing the Old Testament Scripture, they would know who Melchizedek is. That's right. But a person who had no idea of Melchizedek, but knew that Jewish priests had to come from Levi, and Christ is being presented as a priest from the tribe of Judah, that would be a great disconnect there. You're right, but it would be a tremendous hurdle to have to overcome in teaching them truth on this. So, I believe this is the first mention of Melchizedek's name in the book. It's in Hebrews 5 and verse 10. I'm sorry, verse 6, yes. But in this chapter, I believe that's the first mention of his name. So, that being the case, the author has a lot to say to use the priesthood of Melchizedek and to launch into this great discussion of the priesthood of Christ. But now I want you to see, and to me I think this is very important, as you see the way the book is laid out for us. You come to Hebrews 5 and verse 11, he's introduced the priesthood. But what happens in verse 11? What does the writer have to do? I'm going to have to pause this discussion just for a moment. I'm going to talk about this man, but about him we have much to say. Well, who is the him? Christ? No, it's Melchizedek. I've got a lot to say about this man. I've got to cover a lot of points about him so that you, and speaking as the author to his reader, so that you can understand the priesthood of Christ. But I perceive something about you. You don't know what I'm talking about here. And there's a problem. There's a problem. Though we have much to say about him, he says, verse 11 of Hebrews 5, it is hard to explain. Now, does that mean this is like calculus? I mean, this is just deep stuff. That's not the problem. What was the problem? Dull of hearing. See, the problem was not with the material. The problem was with the student. Not able to comprehend because of that reason only. So the author has to pause. This is question 8, middle of page 14. Author is pausing in this discussion. His readers had become dull of hearing. If your Bible has a marginal reference, it may direct you to Hebrews 6 and verse 12. I'm not going to check to see if it does or not, but even if it doesn't, I want you to look at Hebrews 6 and verse 12. Skip ahead just for the moment. Look at that verse. Let me read Hebrews 6 and verse 12 for us, please. Right, that word sluggish, are there other versions that have a different word? Slothful, sluggish. It's the same word in the original text as Hebrews 5, verse 11. Dull of hearing. It's the same word. So we're talking about someone who's dull of hearing is one who is sluggish, one who is slothful. I put in parentheses, spiritually lazy. That's what it is. See, that was their problem. Now, let's say you're dealing, and let's just speak in generalities here for a moment. Let's say you're dealing with a lazy person. I mean, literally a lazy person. How do you solve laziness? Well, some say you can't, but how do you begin to address laziness in a person? Do you coddle it? You prod it, Barbara says. You give them something to do. The answer to laziness is effort, isn't it? And work. To encourage them to get out of this, yes, and go a different direction. You're right. Well, spiritual laziness. Do we have a problem with spiritual laziness in the kingdom? We do. Yeah. Yes. What's comfortable? My family's been on this. That just seems like that's just a natural thing to do. They were obviously being maybe oppressed or persecuted by family and friends in having accepted Christ and being New Testament Christians. And so the path of least resistance, as Ralph puts it, was let's just go back to do what we used to do. Well, that's true. Yeah. That's right. You can't make them better. But we can help them get out of laziness and the answer is effort. The answer is effort to do something. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Showing them the futility of going back to the inferior way. Yes, Craig. That's right. Because of that condition. They could not, he said, for though by this time, what? You ought to be teachers. You have need again for someone to teach you the first principles of the oracles of God. And we'll say more about that, rest of that verse in a moment. But I at least want to cover this. The readers have become dull of hearing or sluggish, spiritually lazy. And it's the same phrase, chapter 6 and verse 12. As it is the last part of verse 11 in chapter 5. Now, let's make a couple of applications in Hebrews 5 and verse 11. It says, you have become dull of hearing. I don't want to read too much into this, but it doesn't say you were born dull of hearing. See, laziness is something that you become. Not something that's forced on you, but something that you become. And so if a person if a saint, a disciple, even today, let's make it relevant to us. What if we're suffering from spiritual laziness? It's a condition that we are. We may deny it, but let's say that's just the truth about it. Well, we have become that way. It's our fault. We can't be a victim. Well, the church where I'm at is just a bunch of problems, and the brethren aren't nice to me, nobody talks to me, and all this we can offer just 100 different excuses, but it's still something that we become. It's my fault if I'm spiritually lazy. He says, you have become dull of hearing. Yes? Yes, they slid by. You are correct. Okay, so that's one application, is that we bring that upon ourselves. But the second point I want to make is in, again, now, verse, this will be verse 12. What do we learn? And I think this would be different from person to person. But the point is, what ought to happen after one becomes a Christian? You're going to have to grow enough so that what? You can teach. Now, someone says, I can't teach. I think the church has historically, and I think this local church is no different. Sometimes elders, whoever they put in charge of managing the curriculum, sometimes have to beg for teachers. I wonder why that's so. I mean, let's get this personal. Let's bring it right down to us. Local churches should never have to beg for teachers. Why? Hebrews 5 and verse 12. We all should be able to teach something. Some people who've been Christians for 20 and 30 and 40 years say, I'm not able to teach. I can't do that. What about that statement? Good or bad? Well, yes, there are. There's more ways to teach. But I'm making this an application to teaching in some kind of a setting, even if it's children. Is that good or bad? I don't think that's good. Surely after 20 or 30 years, you can teach something. Yes, and that's the point he's going to make here in a moment. You're not the mature person who can chew on the meat or on the steak. You still got to have what? You're still on the bottom. You're still covering these elementary principles. You have need someone to teach you again. And so when enough time passes, and again, this is individual. No one can make you grow. No one can make me grow. We have to want to grow. It's individual effort. And enough time goes by, I should be able to teach something to somebody. I should be able to do that. Yeah. Yes. Or be invited somewhere to someone's house and you sit down at the table and they give you a jar of string peas or string carrots. But we're having steak. Well, why is he? Well, he can't eat meat yet. He's still on the baby food. Now, I'm not trying to be silly about it, but that's really the point. We all need to grow. So he's addressing people. Look, I've got an important subject to cover. And I've got to address this first before I can start talking about Melchizedek. You ought to be teachers by this time. Enough time has passed by. So that gets us to thinking. It gets me to thinking. You know, am I where I need to be in my personal growth process? And I encourage you to ask the same thing. Am I where I need to be? Have I become maybe spiritually sluggish? Have I slacked off? Or am I really trying to grow as a disciple? Because there are things that I can teach. And like Freddie said, there are different ways to teach. You teach by example. That's true. But you also teach by word. By talking to people. Being involved in the local church curriculum. That's a way to exercise those teaching abilities that you have somewhat mastered over a period of time. So I just kind of want to put that little plug in there. I think that's one way to apply what we're thinking about here in terms of these principles. So these people, he reminds them of the dietary limitations of babies, verses 13 and 14. After stressing that enough time had passed by, but they weren't teaching, not only were they not teaching, but they needed to be taught. The first principles, or the elementary principles, basic principles of the oracles of God, you need milk, not solid food. Now, how does he describe the one who's limited to the bottle? Verse 13. All right, he's unskilled. Where? In the word of righteousness. Unskilled in the word of righteousness. Since he is a, and most verses use the word babe or a baby, he is a child. He is a small child. But solid food, that is the meat. In fact, the Old King James uses the word meat, doesn't it? Meat is for who? One who are full grown, who for the mature, for those who have their powers of discernment or their senses trained to discern what? Now let's chew on that one for a while. That's no pun intended. Let's think about that for a moment. How do you know right from wrong? Let's just stick to these verses, especially verse 14. How do we know right from wrong? Good from evil? All right, you're going to have to use your mind. Have any of you, and you don't have to show your hand here, but I'll tell a story on myself. I did something one time, I forget now what it was. It was so important, I forgot what it was. But anyway, I disappointed my father greatly. And he gave me that obligatory speech. Son, what were you thinking when you did that? Were you not even thinking? And I mean, it was clearly an obvious choice that I should have made. I wasn't a Christian, but still, it was an issue of right or wrong, obeying or disobeying. And he had laid out his expectations for me just as plain as anything. And I knew what he wanted me, and I just didn't do it. And so I get the lecture, and he says, what were you thinking? Well, what if we aren't able to choose between good and evil? What if we've not trained our senses? See, that's the problem. And so what do we make of New Testament Christians today who involve themselves in things that run contrary to the gospel of Christ? The church has to maybe go to the point of even exercising discipline. What's the problem? Hebrews 5, verse 14. They've not trained their senses. In fact, I think it's the New American Standard. Let me see how that's worded up. I like the way that's phrased. I turned to the right place here. Solid food is for the mature who, because of practice, that is use, practice, have trained their senses to discern good and evil. It's not something that you just intellectually know, but something that you do over a course of time. That's right. That's wrong. This is scriptural. That's not scriptural. This is morally good. That's morally against the will of Christ. And how do you get to be a mature person, a solid disciple? Again, let's just use this passage. You, over time, you exercise your senses. You train your senses. You grow, you do right, you do the will of God, and you look up one day and you're a mature disciple. You're solid over a course of time because you've been practicing that which your Father wants you to do. Yes, Brother Lambert? Mm-hmm. That's a problem. What's wrong with that? Well, that's a good point. Those of you who didn't hear, if you approach someone about something at one time and say, well, I don't see anything wrong with that, and you know better, you know it doesn't fit the will of Christ, well, let's plug them into this passage here, Hebrews 5, 11 through 14. Obviously, what haven't they done? And they haven't grown. So, typically, on this timeline, if we want to fit them on a timeline, where are they? They're on the baby stage at the end of the line. Now, we don't mean to sound harsh or critical here, but I think that's the point the writer's making. If we want to be a mature disciple, useful in the kingdom, useful to our master, able to teach, all those things, well, we're going to have to not be spiritually lazy. We're going to have to be ones who put forth the effort. We're going to have to exercise or use our senses by means of practice to discern good and evil. We're going to have to grow. Now, does it happen any other way? What about people who were raised in homes of elders? Do they have a leg up in this? Well, but do they? I didn't ask if they ought to. Do they get an extra head start? No. What about those who are raised in homes of gospel preachers? No. We all have to go through this same process. What was that, Freddie? They're behind usually. Well, we won't go down that road. But the point is, no one gets a head start. We're all in the same boat on this. When we obey the gospel, we will say, all right, I'm going to grow, I'm going to study, I'm going to learn, I'm going to develop into someone that the Lord can use. And eventually enough time must go by where I can't just keep sitting back and saying, well, I keep wanting to be taught. No. We've got to be teachers eventually. That's the requirement. All right, buddy. That's true. Yes. 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 There are lots of ways to apply this. You are correct. But I think we see the basic point the writer's making. He's got to address something that's very, very critical to his overall message of the priesthood of Christ. And he says, wait, before I do that, I've got to stop here and address this deficiency I see in these people. And it wasn't good. That's a good point to make. Somebody I mean, some people tragically have physical and emotional problems, and some never develop to a full-blown mature adult and have to be treated, as it were, as a child. And that's tragic and that's sad, but that's the reality of living in this world. And so we're compassionate about that. We understand that that's how they are. But talking about this, can someone say, well, that's just how I am? No, that doesn't fly. That doesn't fit what the writer is saying. I think that's a good point to make. We all can grow, but it takes effort on our part, individually. Yes, Cornelia. Yeah, but is it a contest? It's not a contest. I mean, some are more skilled at it than others, yes. But it's not a point. Who does it best? Let's put them out there in the front. No, that's not the point. The point is, are you able to teach something? Are you able to do something? Have you tried to hone and grow your abilities to some point that you can function as a needed disciple? Because there's plenty of work to do. I mean, you ask any eldership. Ask this eldership or any other eldership. Which is it? Is there a shortage of work or is there a shortage of talent? Which one is it usually? What's the answer? A talent. Or people wanting to help. I mean, is it, well, you know, we'd like to have, but we've got all our bases, there's nothing else to do. I mean, we've got everything covered, so thanks for volunteering anyway. That never happens that I know of. There's always something to do. Always work to do. But sometimes it seems that, well, we have a shortage of people who are wanting to get involved. And that's the problem. So this, to me, this is a very pointed, hard-hitting passage and makes us take stock in ourselves, individually. Yes, Warren? Well, all right. Mm-hmm. Yes? That's right. That is true. Yes, that's the point. Yes, that is the point. Yes, obviously the five-talent man could do more than the one-talent man. That's true. But was the one-talent man still held accountable? Yes, he was. He still had to do something. No, that's or the two-talent man. You're right. He was held to the point of what he could do. And I think that's a great analogy to make also. All right. See, there's a lot to talk about with respect to this passage, Hebrews 5, 11 to 14, and it's just as relevant to us today as if we were the ones to whom this was addressed specifically, these New Testament Jewish Christians. All right, Bill? Yeah. That's a good story. Okay, good example. All right. We don't want to beat this to death, but I think you see, I just think there's a lot of good thought to give to how this really applies to me. And I think if all we do is think about, yeah, these poor Jewish Christians, I tell you what, I don't know what was wrong with them. And we don't think about ourselves. Right? We're missing a real learning moment here if we don't apply this to ourselves. And so he does talk about their dietary limitations. Only the mature can handle meat. Only the mature have train their senses. Immature haven't done that yet. It would make as much sense as if we had Brad and Tiffany Merle over and gave Luke a piece of meatloaf for lunch. I mean, you just don't do that. He's not able to handle that yet. But time will pass where he can chew on that. And that's the point he's making. Enough time goes by. I need to be doing more than just living on the bottle, talking about first principles. I need to do more. And if I'm not, then I think I need to say about myself, verse 11, I am dull of hearing. Chapter 6, verse 12, I am sluggish. I am slothful. Just pause for self-evaluation. Okay. Yes, sir. Go ahead. Yes, right. No. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely, right. And there's something that can be said for the process of mentoring, training teachers, helping them to grow so that one day they can stand on their own two feet and teach some of the more deeper things in the Scripture. That is true. There's nothing wrong with that, with those kinds of processes. But he is addressing here the absence of this ability. And it wasn't because this was a skill that I just can't develop. I mean, I can't be a welder. Freddie can weld all day long. I can't do that. I've not been trained to do that. Maybe I can learn it. I sincerely doubt it. But the point is, these are things that we can learn to do and can grow. And that's really his point. Okay. Well, we're out of time. And I'm not going to go any further because I think it would be just leaving something hanging. Next week is a holiday in terms of the school system. Now, we're still going to have class even if only two or three show up. That's all right. But if you have kids at home, bring them on. It doesn't bother me if kids are here. Or if you have already got something planned, I certainly will leave that to your discretion. But we will have class next Tuesday if only a few show up, or if everybody shows up, that'll be good too. So we'll pick up then, the Lord willing, on question 10, page 14, Hebrews chapter 6. Thanks for your good comments and participation this morning.